Hey, it's Lauren Fox, the host of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Andrew Hansen and I have the week off, so take a moment and enjoy some highlights from some of our past shows. We are going to talk about horse racing, and I don't know that that has ever happened, but I guess if you're going to talk about horse racing, might as well talk about the Kentucky Derby. Might as well talk about it with a guy who was there and had a rooting interest, as did all of Southern New Hampshire. Like, I can't think of that happening at any point in time when I've lived here. The only real connection to New Hampshire for the Kentucky Derby that I can think of, oddly enough, is if you're driving to the beach, you see that Dancer's Image 1968 Kentucky Derby champion, which oddly enough came back into play in this year's race 51 years later. We'll get to that in a second. Dan Casey of Sovereign Stables. Dan, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, anytime. So, first of all, I've got to know, I saw the pictures on Facebook. How long did it take you to get all of that apparel together to go down there? Or is that already part of your wardrobe?
So this trip was probably the hardest thing I think you could ever imagine. Luckily, my brother-in-law, Matt Gassett, is a pseudo traveler in his spare time. He loves planning this stuff, but it was unreal to try to get all this pulled together. But, it turned out to be a pretty spectacular weekend.
Yeah, it sounds like it was a great weekend. Seemed like a lot of fun, and I'll turn it over to Hansen because he's got some more of the actual horse racing questions aside from your sartorial splendor.
Yeah, well, before we get into the Derby day itself, let's tell our listeners a little bit about this horse Vekoma, and how did you first hear about the horse and see it and realize that it could be special out there on the track? I guess that kind of goes to show how difficult it is to find a horse that's going to qualify for the Kentucky Derby when you're buying, you're in a group of investors and you may buy 5 to 10 horses a year, and it takes a long time to find one that's that good. What was the process like for Vekoma to be successful and start winning races to be able to qualify for the Derby? Yeah, it certainly worked out, and we saw that he won multiple races to gain enough points to qualify. So then take us down to Churchill Downs, the day of the Derby. You're there with your family, and you've got a horse in the race. What was it like to be in that position?
I mean, I don't know if you guys are both into sports, obviously, and Louisville is just a fun town. I was actually, one time I was making a taxi. We went to the Louisville Slugger Museum, and, the kids, first of all, they had a blast. And, Michael, my father-in-law, he's not old. He's 66 years old, been successful in business, but he's always had this passion. He's always dreamed about going to Derby and to be there with, we had 12 of us in our group. Michael had his brother, executive counselor Ted Grass is down there with his wife, another local sports legend, and Billy LeBurge somehow stuck into the group and he was down there. So, Friday in Churchill is the female big race, the Oak, it's a cancer awareness day. So everyone's down there. Friday's kind of a chill day, everyone's dressed in pink and, having a good time. And Derby Day, we stayed at a downtown hotel and we're down for coffee in the lobby at 7 in the morning, and there's people in hats and dresses and suits, and they're all there for the same thing. It doesn't matter if they're a horse owner or a spectator, they're there for arguably, I think, one of the greatest events in sports. So the town is hopping, the track is hopping. It's just a surreal experience to not only be there, but once you put that badge on with your jockey silk that you're in the race, it's just a different world. It's just the line, the jury taking your left when everyone's going right. It was just it was a really, really fun experience. And to put it to this way, after the whole thing, I think my sister-in-law wrote, if we had that much fun coming in 12th place, imagine if we would have won.
I would say true words are never spoken. Yeah, the atmosphere down there, I mean, that's, as a sports fan, regardless whether you're a horse racing fan, going to that race is a bucket list item. And for you to have that opportunity, particularly with that kind of a vested interest, had to absolutely be insane. We're with Dan Casey, who is with Sovereign Stables, that had Vekoma that was entered into the Kentucky Derby and finished 12th. Now, once the race started, your thoughts and emotions, actually, like, now it's go time. Not to mention the conditions on the track were best described as soupy.
It would be an understatement. We actually got the benefit of being able to go out to the barn before the race and walk the horse onto the track from the barn area all the way up, the first turn of the track and into the paddock. And soupy, my son had a poncho on and a baseball hat. And when we got to the paddock with Tacoma, Brody had mud on his hat somehow. It was just, people were walking with no shoes. It was an off track for sure. But I mean, you had about 18 horses in the race. Tacoma came in. His mother was a mud horse. Unfortunately, Tacoma never ran him in the mud. But, it was an off track. So, up to race time, it's pouring out. All you want to do is, no different than anything else. You just want to get a good start. You want to get out of the gate. So call my dad out of the gate strong, had a clear path. In those conditions, as soon as the horse starts getting some mud kicked up in his face, it kind of turns a little bit. But, he got a good stretch. First turn was great. Back stretch was great. Again, you're competing against 18, 17 other of the best horses in the world to qualify for that race. So unfortunately, around the last turn, where maximum security created his foul, Coma did get pinched a little bit. Probably cost him maybe 3 or 4 spots. It would have been great to finish in top 10, but the horse came out of the race sound, went back to the barn, ears were perked, immediately hit the hay, the feed bag. So, we could have asked for the horse to come out any better than obviously the result, but the horse came out of the race sound.
So what were you thinking about halfway through the race when it looked like Vekoma was in the top 5? And yeah, were you thinking, gosh, how is Vekoma going to react here in the mud, since Vekoma's never run in the mud? Or were you thinking, hey, here comes the kick, we actually have a chance at this?
Yeah, it's tough because, you're following all the digital boards, you're following the reaction of the fan, and you could see Vekoma there, but you're sitting there and you could just tell he wasn't taken to the track. He's got a really kind of weird front kick where it's almost like his leg comes out like he's kind of tripping on a horse, but it's just his funky stride, and he just didn't have always that great thing. You're in the race. I mean, why shouldn't you win? It's an off track. You know, the favorite scratched out, you know, 5 or 6 days earlier. You start thinking, okay, we've got a shot at this. And again, it's 43,000 horses born a year trying to get this race. It is a hard race to win. So, you know, we couldn't be happier with how we've come, how we got us there, and we're excited for the future.
Yeah, it's an amazing accomplishment and historic event for you guys. And then, of course, it was a historic race with the controversy. What was your take on what happened with Maximum Security, and what was it like being there at the track waiting for the results to be official?
So Maximum Security was a 7-horse. We were the 6-horse. Our back was right next to the owner's. I mean, there's a right when the horse went Maximum Security, the NBC stands for the owners, and my kids are standing right behind the owners. So, you know, you're witnessing somebody, a family, a group of friends at the highest of highs, and you're happy for them. You didn't win, but you're happy that the guys next to you, that you're seeing that joy, because it makes you want to get back there again next year. And then you immediately see, you know, maybe 5 minutes later, an inquiry, and you go from the highest of highs of winning the Kentucky Derby to the lowest of lows. I mean, you can hear a pin drop in that box, and you feel for it. I mean, zeroing out is part of racing. I mean, these are 3-year-old horses. They're not mature. They've run 3 or 4 races in their lifetime, so zeroing out is part of it. But unfortunately, what happened was the horse went maybe from the 1 spot to the 5 spot, 5 lane in a race, and it affected a 3rd, 4th, and 5th place outcome. That, you know, Kentucky Derby pays out the top 5 spots. I think if you come in 5th place, you get, I think it's $90,000. But once you start affecting what's going on behind you, not only are you affecting monetary, you know, payouts of from the track, but you're affecting wages. You're affecting trifectas, superfectas. So it's one of those tough things that, you know, like Lauren mentioned at the beginning, the only other time that there's been a disqualification in a derby was when there was another New Hampshire horse in the race, and Jansen's image. So it's just weird how the stars aligned for that one.
Yeah, so it sounds like you would trend towards the side of, hey, it's unfortunate, but because he ducked out that far, you understand that the disqualification was made. You would support that decision?
You know, you have to. The only troubling part is this has never happened. And everyone can think, you know, okay, they didn't win the derby, but Maximum Security was the best horse in the race. You know, he won the race, unfortunately got disqualified, but not only is he not a Kentucky Derby champion, but that affects his breeding rights down the way. That affects his stud fee. It just affects so much of that that goes into Maximum Security. It's tough to fathom that happening. But, you know, he did veer out. Do I support it? It's racing, but, you know, Stewart, I wouldn't want to be a Stewart in Churchill right now.
No, I would not want to have to make that call. That is and we're here with Dan Casey, who ran Vekoma in the Kentucky Derby. He was part of the Gatsa Stables team. You weren't riding him. You were along for the ride, I guess, as it were. But you look at sports now and think back to, and Hansen will know what I'm talking about, like the 1985 World Series. You have a guy who's clearly out at first base. He's ruled safe at first base. That changes the complexion of an inning. With instant replay, everything is different. And with the number of angles that we have and the way that we're able to slow things down significantly, even for those of us, if you're just videoing it on a phone, I can watch my kids' game and tell if somebody's safe or out. It has added a very different dimension to sporting events when particularly you think about, okay, if something happens in a football game and 5 seconds run off the clock, early in the game, nobody's saying anything. 5 seconds run off the clock late in the game. It's wait a second. Scoreboard operator, please reset the clock to whatever. And almost you wonder, all right, if Maximum Security had made a move like that earlier in the race, would that have been something that would have even been considered? Or was it only a foul or ruled a foul because of where it was in the race and what was going on?
Yeah, I don't think it would have been. You know, there could have been an inquiry early in the race, but it actually affected War of Will. It affected some horses that could have probably been in the 3rd or 4th spot, where, again, that affects position, but also affects, you know, wages, which you have to think about.
Right.
You know, the thing about horse racing is you're not playing, just
And so then there's the, talk about a tough sport, and once the race is over, you've got that tough decision of, for all those horses in the Derby, are you going to race in the Preakness? So how did the Vekoma team decide whether Vekoma would race in the Preakness?
Yeah, so I mean, pretty much you think about it and you say, you know what, Vekoma got you to the Derby. He did his part. To be fair to the horse, running 2 weeks after the Derby, horses usually get probably about, you know, three and a half, 4 weeks, sometimes longer off between their next race. So we looked at it, you know, and there's a bright future for Vekoma. Our family spends a ton of time up in Saratoga for the summer, so, you know, there's no better spot other than the Derby. There's no better spot to be than Saratoga. You know, it's a track up in upstate New York. It's only open for 9 weeks during the summer. It's the place to be. So Vekoma got some rest, shipped back to Florida, started training again. So, you know, they'll map out some races. I think there's a race in Ace at Belmont that could be a potential fit. But definitely targeting Saratoga for Vekoma.
It doesn't seem like a bad time to be a racehorse like that, where you get a few weeks off. But I would have to imagine, too, for the horse, going through the Derby is probably a lot like going through a heavyweight fight. And you wouldn't expect a heavyweight fighter to come back 2 weeks after the fact and defend their title or get back into the ring again. So it's really a difficult ask of the horse, and nice that he'll have a little bit of downtime as well.
Yeah, definitely. He's got a great future,
that's for sure. Well, I'm glad that you guys were along for the ride. It was certainly a lot of fun for us. Having some kind of a local angle in the Derby, and even though he wound up finishing 12th, as your wife had indicated, it was so much fun finishing 12th. Imagine what would have happened if he would have won.
Absolutely.
Well, best of luck this summer. I'm sure you guys will enjoy it, and thank you for your time.
Yeah, appreciate you guys having me.
Take care, Dan.
All right, talk soon.
All right, thanks, Danny.
Hey, it's Lauren Fox, the host of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Andrew Hansen and I have the week off, so take a moment and enjoy some highlights from some of our past shows.
As our audience gets to hear the phone ringing, the telephone is ringing. Is that my mother on the phone?
Hi, this is Mike.
Hey, what's going on, dude? It's Lauren Fox and Andrew Hansen. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. You're not live on the air, but we're recording this. That would be scary. Right. No, we were talking about something else, and I was like, well, we got to call Ram. So, yeah, here you are. We're recording you. We're with Mike Ramshaw, the president of the New Hampshire Fisher Cats. Welcome to the program, dude.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
How's life?
Life is good. It's been a busy year. Just got back from Richmond for the Eastern League All-Star Game. So first full day back in the office. Carney and the Richmond Flying Squirrels did a tremendous job.
Carney. I haven't thought about that guy.
Hasn't changed a bit. You know, he's got his funky pants, and during the Home Run Derby, they actually had all the Eastern League executives and sponsors on the actual infield dirt with netting in front and then targets in the outfield. And you want to guess what was the center field target in a lift? Any guess? Parney.
Parney?
Parney was in a lift, and if you hit the lift, you got 50 points. If you hit the lift or he caught the ball while on the lift, you lost 25 points. And wouldn't you know, the third ball that was hit in the Home Run Derby was caught by Parney. It was the only one that was caught. So it was funny.
Todd Parnell, who has been a minor league baseball executive for, I almost went to work for him in the 15 years ago, maybe. But yeah, he's been around a while.
Very long time. And he is a character. You got to love him.
He is. Did you, because obviously the Flying Squirrels used to be run by Bill Papierniak. Was Bill around there at all? Bill's moved on to private industry, but.
You know what? I did not see him.
I don't want
to say he was or wasn't, but I did not see him.
He was the one who got me into this whole mess. He was my first boss in minor league baseball. So
really?
Yeah. It's minor league baseball, for those that don't know it, Hanson's sitting here, he knows because he played, is a bizarrely small world.
No doubt about it.
Yeah. Everybody, it's like 1 degree of separation from everybody, which makes it a lot of fun and also scary at the same time. So,
right.
All right. So for you guys, big day on Monday, Primary Bank's doing an event out there. Tim Schaller, formerly of the Bruins, who grew up in Merrimack, and Chris Carpenter will be out there raising some funds for the Boys and Girls Club. How can people get involved and go out and see you guys on Monday?
Yeah, first and foremost, you know, really big thanks to Primary Bank for working with us and helping us set this up. You know, Chris has been a tremendous supporter of the organization. You know, we've never had Tim out here, but I look forward to meeting him. If you want to purchase tickets, you can go online at nhfishercats.com, and you actually will purchase tickets for the game on Monday, and then they'll ask for a promo code, and it's very important that you enter promo code PRIMARY. When you enter that promo code, $4 for every ticket that gets purchased, we'll go back to the Manchester Boys and Girls Club. You can also go on our social media, Facebook. I know for us and Primary Bank, we have links there. That might actually be the easiest way to do it. If you're on Facebook, you just click right through that link and enter the primary code or the promo code primary so that the Manchester Boys and Girls Club gets that $4.
I was going to say, too, Primary Bank also has pretty explicit instructions on their website. So that's at primarybanknh.com. But it's a lot of fun. I think you'll like Tim. We had him out at the bank, a year and change ago. He's just a really fun dude. And obviously his brother, Dave, used to work at the Fisher Cats as well.
Right.
So, yeah.
And if I can interrupt, are other things that they can do. There's also, if you go on the social media page, you'll see that there's an auction on there for the on-field BP to raise money. And then we partnered with the Ted Williams Hitters Hall of Fame. They're actually donating some stuff for us for a silent auction with all those proceeds going to the Boys and Girls Club of Manchester. So everyone's stepping up to help out a great organization.
That's really cool.
And the weather's going to be great.
Yes.
I called it.
The weather's going to be perfect. So this year, I'm saying the past, not anything leading up to this. The single biggest enemy in minor league baseball is unpredictable weather. And for you, like, I think about how the season went for me when I was coaching the freshman baseball team. And I think about our softball season in the old man softball league. The amount of games that have been changed or postponed. How's it been for you guys with the weird weather so far?
It was definitely an interesting April and May. I want to say there were 5 days in total in the month of April that it did not rain. but fortunately, with the great grounds crew staff and front office staff helping out here, I think we only missed one or two games in April. We're down 4 games for the year. What was really neat, not neat, what was weird is how cold it was. It was rainy and cold for so long. And then once Memorial Day hit, that was our stretch of good weather. But we've dodged some bullets. You know, there's been some rain, you know, that you'd think would be hit us and all of a sudden disappears when it's coming from the west to the east. You know, it's just a matter of timing. You know, I don't care if it rains early in the morning. As long as once noon hits, that rain's gone, that's perfectly fine. You just don't want people, as they're getting ready to go out and come visit us here at the ballpark, that's when you don't want the rain. But I've learned in 3 years of running the team here is control what you control. I'm not going to get stressed out. I can't control the weather. Let's make the best of it. Do what we do best. If it works out, it works out. If it doesn't, we'll move on and we'll do it again the next day.
Again, that's very zen of you. That's actually a Mickey Rivers quote for the old Yankee and Angel center fielder. I'll send it to you. It's funny. So I know the home run derby, of course. I know Hanson and I were sitting there texting back and forth about that.
Oh yeah, we've been talking about it on the show. The incredible display that Vlad Jr. put on was really memorable, and of course he made a lot of positive memories for the Fisher Cats fans last year playing in Manchester. What was it like having him on the team and then being able to watch him put on that display in the Home Run Derby this week?
It was really, last year was a special year. I've said that many times. You know, really, I don't know that I'll ever see a team of that caliber again in my career. I mean, that's kind of like the finding the golden egg. Great guy. Vlad is really great, and John Schneider, who was throwing BP for him, also one of the nicest human beings I've ever met. You know, it was great. It was really cool watching that. We were actually at a concert for the All-Star game, listening to Big and Rich, and we had all these phones watching the Home Run Derby, and it was funny. You knew when it started because all of a sudden my phone started lighting up from friends here at home going, oh my goodness, look what Vlad is doing.
Oh, dude.
It was so fun and entertaining. Not only to watch, but then to see how excited they were, how excited John was, how excited Vlad was, how excited everybody was, just to be able to put on a performance. And who would have thought he hit, 91 home runs and you don't win it?
Yeah, right. How about that? Jeez.
he broke a record in every single round and still didn't win it. But, yeah, you know what? That is what it is.
It's It's absolutely crazy. And the fact that Pete Alonso won it by way of a walk-off in each of his last three rounds, and what kind of luck did he have to be the last guy batting in every round? Like, it's crazy. And it's funny, you mentioned John Schneider. Schneider was catching in Charleston, West Virginia when I was broadcasting in Hagerstown back in 2003.
Wow.
Like, again, this one degree, one degree of there, it's everywhere, dude. So
I sent John a text that, you know, that night going, wow, unbelievable show. And he goes, Mike, he goes, what an amazing experience for all. It was so much fun.
Yeah, ice your arm, dude. Ice your arm. We're with Mike Ramshaw, the president of the Fisher Cats. And all right, we're going to make it short and easy on you. If you're the commissioner of Major League Baseball, what do you do to get more people interested in the game?
Very easy. What I would do is I would create more of the minor league experience at the major league level. There's a reason why you know, other sports have seen declining attendance when minor league sports, particularly baseball, has either slowly had some slow growth or maintained. And that's because of the entertainment and experiences that we provide. I think if you're able to provide unique experiences for fans and give them reasons to keep coming back, I think that's how you get more people out to the ballpark. Less corporate, more family. That's what you got to do.
It's the real challenge. And we had when I was working for the Dodgers single A team out in Southern California in 07 and 08, they used to send their front office out to games. And they'd come out and see the mascot, and they'd come out and see the between inning promotions. And they incorporated, oddly enough, they incorporated some of the stuff that we did. But the difficulty sometimes can be, all right, you have a stadium of 6,500. They have a stadium of 60,000. And some of the things that really can work in that close-up environment are difficult to get to work in a bigger stadium. But what specifically, as far as the experience, would you incorporate?
Well, I mean, there's so many. I mean, it's difficult to pick one. I would try a little bit of everything that's worked for us and other markets and see what works in the major league level. I hear what you're saying. It's a lot easier to do, you know, play catch on the field when there's 6,500 people. So you have maybe, you know, 1,500, 2,000 kids on the field that are part of a group when you have 65,000 or 60,000 people.
Yeah.
But little things like that, I mean, the between inning promotions, you know, the different unique, and you're seeing them do it more and more now. I know, I mean, I'm sure you remember, Lauren, when we worked together, you know, Major League was like, you know what, we don't need to do that. You know, we were right. Kind of a joke. And you look now, every industry, these people are, they're creating that family entertainment, that fun environment to keep people engaged. You know, it's now all of a sudden they're doing what we've been doing all along.
Right. Or they're at least trying to. I don't
Correct.
Think, I still don't think they have a handle on it. And it goes back to, I had people with big time ad agencies back in, you know, 10, 15 years ago telling me that the best ideas that they would hear weren't coming from brainstorming corporate meetings. They were coming from minor league baseball.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's how you can make it so that sort of environment, that welcoming environment, make it at ticket prices more affordable for people. That would certainly help
for sure.
out. And the secondary ticket market has helped out with that to some degree, but yeah.
If I can add too, Lauren,
yeah.
You know, one of the things that you don't see a lot or you don't see as much is that the community aspect, you know, how involved on the minor league level you are with the community and doing events at the ballpark, you don't see as much of it. Not that they don't do it, but you don't see as much of it or you don't hear about as much of it when you go to a major league game. You know, so if there's more of a way to tie that in, you know, because we learned very quickly that once you embrace and make the ballpark the center of the community, then the community will embrace you. I think it's really important to do that and stay on top of it.
Well, absolutely, Mike. The one time our family got to come out this year was when the Bedford Little League had their night at the ballpark, and when the Bedford Little League players and parents were encouraged to come, and we came out, and the kids got to run the bases after the game, and they'll always have that memory. So that's one of those ways where you're connecting with this community, and it's a great tradition. So hope that can keep going, moving forward.
You have to, right? In order to be successful, you have to keep creating those memories. That's what we're in the business of doing, is creating memories.
And, you know, I said it back when I was working there, but, you know, I obviously believe it. They're lucky to have a guy like you to do it. There's no better ambassador for the team. There's no better ambassador for the game. And we certainly appreciate you coming on and joining us.
Well, I appreciate that very much.
All right, buddy. We will we'll talk to you soon, and hope to see you soon and give you a hug.
All right. Sounds good. Thanks, guys.
All right, brother. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Hey, it's Lauren Fox, the host of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Andrew Hansen and I have the week off, so take a moment and enjoy some highlights from some of our past shows. Welcome back to Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. Lauren Fox, Andrew Hansen, and we are joined by a very special guest. I'm just going to refer to him as the former voice of the Sioux Falls Canaries and St. Paul Saints, but the one of the radio broadcasters for the Minnesota Twins. The biggest surprise in baseball this year, the Minnesota Twins, Chris Atterbury. Chris, welcome to the program.
Yeah, are we the biggest surprise in baseball?
That's my thought. I mean, unless you know something I don't.
No, we'll take it. I'll take biggest surprise in baseball. I think that's fine. The funny thing is, the Twins are legitimately a good team, and they've played legitimately good baseball against the only other like five good teams in the American League. And yet people still are shocked on either coast that the Twins are even remotely good. The A's were just in here. They swaggered in here with their, you know, nobody respects us thing. And we're like, well, you guys aren't good. You're not going to make the playoffs. I mean, you know, the Twins are just a function of a bad division. And then we played like four meat grinder games and split with them. It's really interesting. And then the Boston Riders last night, when the Boston Red Sox are pummeling the Yankees in large part because the Yankees got in a bloodbath three-game series here in Minnesota and showed up at 4 in the morning, Boston Riders are like, these ain't the Twinkies. You're not coming back on us. I'm like, you know, we beat you 2 out of 3 games, so maybe we just kind of temper the attitude a little bit. But, yeah, no, it's a good team. And I don't think we're shocked here because I think we thought we had a bunch of players who were entering their prime. We added a new manager. We had a guy like Nelson Cruz, which makes you better in every aspect of your organization. And so I don't think we're shocked, but pleasantly happy with where we are and not satisfied quite yet with where we are.
Okay, so it's a function of great timing because you have guys like Byron Buxton who are entering into their prime. You throw Nelson Cruz into the mix. There have been other acquisitions that have certainly played a role in it, but I mean, it's not smoke and mirrors at this point. You're 100 games in and still playing 600 ball. The other acquisition, I guess, offseason acquisition is a guy who's still young by managerial standards, Rocco Baldelli. What do you see from him that is different than what you had seen previously?
Well, so Rocco is, he's the youngest manager at 37, and he's your classic modern manager. The game is different now, and where you've got to be in a straight line, not just from your GM chair to your manager, but also like through your entire developmental process in the minor leagues. That's just the way this thing is going. And so you have to be progressive. You have to be open-minded. And then the role of the manager has changed from the, you know, I'm the sheriff and here's how it's going to be guy to the communicator. So you've got a floor full of analysts and you've got concepts of how you want to build a team and different things that you want to utilize and maximize. And then you need somebody who can sift all that down and have the respective players and communicate with them in a fashion where they don't feel like, you know, you're feeding the geese for pate. They feel like they're being respected and that their opinions are being heard. And that's what he's really, really good at. And his staff, Derek Shelton's really good too. But it's also a function of, so when Molly went to the playoffs 2 years ago, the team kind of probably arrived a little before it was ready. And then they regressed last year way more than they should have, in large part due to the fact that they just didn't have players. They missed Polanco for half a year because he got popped for PEDs. They missed Buxton and Snow essentially for the entire year. Well, it's those three guys plus Kepler, plus Rosario, plus Barrios, who was an all-star last year. That's your core. And so they're all healthy for the most part this year, and they're all entering that 25 to 27-year-old window when they should be at their peak. And so throw those guys, add in the veterans, sprinkle the veterans around them like Nelson Cruz, the emergence of Mitch Garber, who's part of that core as well, and then add Rocco's touch, his deft touch with how he treats these guys, and it's a pretty good combination. It's still short on pitching, but that's true of every single team in baseball.
Well, the thing that's jumped out to me, Chris, as I look at the numbers, are the outburst of home runs. The Twins have hit a major league leading 199 home runs this season. That's 25 more than any other team. They've got 11 players who've hit at least 9 home runs. What can explain this change, this outburst of home runs over there?
Well, Rob Manfred's baseball factory is probably a big part of it. And then we've got good players, you know, and there's a lot of bad pitching in the league. I mean, those are, if you want to really be truthful, those are all the factors that go into it together. Last night they hit 5 homers. It's the 9th time they've done that this year. First team in baseball history to hit To have 9 games of 5 homers or more. They're on pace to shatter the all-time home run record, which will probably last half a season. The balls are part of it. They are flying all over the place. These are Titleist. The fact that Major League Baseball owns the factory and still can't explain what happened to them makes them like the worst supply chain managers in history. So that's part of it. The ball definitely carries better. But that's the nature of the swing now, right, is that we're going to get out in front of the ball, and we're gonna hit it in the air, and we're gonna hit it hard. That's your plan. Now the thing that has changed is when this launch revolution started with Billy Beane and the A's saying, "Wow, everybody's throwing sinkers and sliders. Let's get under the ball and lift it." You know, there's more money to be made in the air than on the ground. When that started, they were sacrificing strikeouts for home runs. And then as we saw 2 years ago, first with the Astros, wow, suddenly they lead the world in home runs and they don't strike out. And then last year, if you look at the best teams in baseball, were Boston, Houston, and Cleveland. They all hit bombs, they didn't strike out at all, and they stole a bunch of bases because suddenly nobody did that except them. And we were hiring catchers who couldn't throw because all we wanted them to do was frame. And so the Twins have managed to hit a ton of home runs, and they don't strike out very much. And that's, again, the big misconception. Everyone's like, oh, they have to strike out to hit bombs. And they don't. And they play in a very neutral ballpark. They've actually hit more home runs on the road than they have at home. What they do in terms of how their home runs come is they're 1 through 9, everybody can hit. And then they wear out starters. And then they get into the meaty long relief, and then they crush it. They hit more home runs there than it's third time through the order than most clubs. They make really good adjustments. So the Yankees were just here, like I said. And the Yankees had only had 17 games all year where their starter didn't go 5. They didn't get a starter through 4 innings against us in 3 games. And they won 2 of those games. And that just takes its toll. And as poor as some of the division is, with Detroit, Kansas City, the White Sox all rebuilding, the Twins have played the fewest games against the Central than anybody. Now, sure, they hit a billion home runs against Baltimore, but you know what? Boston and Tampa and New York get to play Baltimore 19 times. That should be 200 home runs right there. So you can't just say it's schedule. I think it's just good hitters in their prime, taking advantage of a league where the pitching hasn't been very good top to bottom, and the balls are like cue balls.
Joined by Chris Atterbury, one of the voices of the Minnesota Twins. And so if you're Rob Manfred and you can't explain why this is going on
or won't,
but I mean, everybody sort of agrees that this is a challenge and the pace of play within the games is a challenge. You know, you're talking the Angels played 6 hours and 19 minutes last night against the Orioles. So all of this is a challenge. And the game to the common fan is by and large lost because it's turned into this sort of glorified home run derby. Is it as easy as you just change the baseballs and put the genie back in the jar or what?
You know, I think it's more complicated than that, and I also think the narrative isn't that simple. You know, people keep telling us that fans don't like baseball and young fans hate the game and they don't have the attention span for it, and yet our attendance is up leaps and bounds, and we sold the place out 5 times last week, and our TV and radio ratings are skyrocketing through the roof.
That's because of you, though. That's you.
And so, it's probably mostly me.
That's the Atterbury effect, yes.
So I don't think that people don't like it. I you can't tell me that nobody likes it because they keep coming. And so I think that narrative is a little bit twisted. I think the thing we always say is pace of play, and I know the manager loves that, or the commissioner loves to say pace of play and we're losing fans. But the big issue, if you really drill down, is they're fine with the game in the ballparks. They're concerned about the game on all the billion different platforms that they want to take money from. How is it on TV? Oh, it's too long on TV. Oh, we're not on YouTube and we're not on Facebook Live and we can't maximize our dollars on all of these other digital channels. That's a different game altogether than the game that you see in the ballpark, where the commissioner has even admitted in the ballpark we're fine. But now we're trying to tailor it to this digital audience as opposed to the fans of the fans. And I think that's where you can't really have it both ways. You don't get to complain about both ways, or you don't get to use it as a wedge in an increasingly vitriolic relationship with the union where you want to flex your muscles and dance around the union every time you win a little battle. So I think that's part of it. I don't think when we say pace of play, we mean pace of play. I think pace of play is code for terrible baseball. I think it's code for people who can't throw strikes. And I think it's code for people who got rushed to the major leagues because they're cheaper. There's a bunch of, you could put a team together of guys right now who have 5 to 7 years of major league experience and are professional players who can throw strikes, make contact, throw to the right base, and do all these fundamental baseball things. but you're not going to win the World Series with them. So why am I going to pay them $5 million a year when I can pay $550,000 to a rookie with some talent and try to utilize him until he becomes expensive and then dismiss him? So I think that's more of what's going on, is there are players, honestly, who just they're rushed to the big leagues. Because if you're one of these rebuilding teams, which constitutes about, I would say, 22 of the teams in the league, they're not going to pay to be average or okay. They're going to stay cheap and grow talent. And there's a lot of talent, don't get me wrong, but it's not really cultured talent or nurtured talent. And all you have to do is look through the middle relief corps of pretty much every team in baseball and see that what we're having a problem with isn't pace of play. It's ball one, ball two, 2-1, 3-1, 3-2, foul ball, walk, because it's bad baseball. So I think that's bad baseball nobody wants to watch. When we have a four-hour game in the World Series, it's an instant classic. When we have a four-hour game between the Orioles and the Tigers in August, it's a problem for the game, and fans don't want to watch it. You don't get that in both ways.
Yeah, it is tough, and the pitching changes have certainly not helped. You watch a game on TV, and I guess it was meant to be leisurely to a degree, but there is something nice about a game being done in 2.5-3 hours. The game that you see, and you probably don't watch a whole lot of high school baseball because you're watching big league games every day. Mm-hmm. The game that you see still at a youth level, once they move to the big field or once they are at a high school level, is sort of what baseball was even 5 years ago, where they didn't.
Yeah.
Nobody really has the ability to put the ball over the fence, so they're not going to even try. It's a matter of how do we sort of play that chess match and try to scratch runs across, which I think there is a lot of excitement for the fans in a home run. That's something that doesn't really require a whole lot of explanation to anybody. A triple is a little bit more nuanced and more exciting. And, you know, you, me, and Hanson get excited about guys hitting cutoffs and, you know, a guy like, all right, is he going to stretch the double into a triple? We get geeked out about sacrifice bunts, stolen bases. But that sort of stuff to an average fan who's got an attention span of 5 seconds is kind of lost.
Well, and I think it's the skill set's lost because the way players are acquired. First of all, I never complain about teams trying to win, like figuring out the best ways to win, right? If you can maximize your chance to win a game by having your pitcher play first base and then come back in and pitch again.
Oh, dude, I love that.
You're right. That is your right. It's just like in college. You can run the option if you think it's your best way to utilize your talent, or you can run the spread. And I think that different brands of baseball make for more exciting baseball. We hate playing the Royals because they still play like it's 1977. They're all super fast. They catch everything, and they run all over the place. And baseball, through its history, is all about the back and forth, right? Like, now everybody throws four-seamers up, and nobody throws sinkers because they changed the swing to hit the sinker. Well, someone's going to change the swing to hit the four-seamer, right? And then someone's going to start doing what Matt Olson does in Oakland and bunt against the shift for doubles. And then you're going to have to not shift anymore. And the game goes back and forth, and that's how baseball moves on. But the players that play in the big leagues and get drafted and get scouted, what do? They don't hit the cutoff guy in the high school game. They go to a showcase, they get three swings, and the guy who hits the ball the farthest gets everybody's attention. In the same way, the pitchers don't go to a tryout or a showcase or a travel all-star team to show off their cunning command or their beautiful fadeaway changeup. They got to pop the radar gun or nobody's going to talk to them. And it becomes an issue because those are the guys now that are playing, and they've never had to, A, play for a real team because they just ship around to showcases. And they don't understand, I think, a lot of the time, score and inning and situational baseball because they've never played in a team environment. They've been so good for so long that they've just been a hired gun, like Paladin, you know, going around and playing every weekend for somebody different. And I think that's part of where the overall fabric of winning baseball goes away, because what was winning baseball for years was about continuity and subtlety, and those things don't get you drafted. Velocity gets you drafted, power gets you drafted. And now I think we're seeing with more of the data, I'm going to draft Hanson because his spin rate's good, not his velocity necessarily. And we think we can work with that. Or we like what the bat blaster centers are telling us about his wrists. And, you know, so we're taking it to different places, but we're still largely taking the raw talent. For all the talk about, you know, how you can make yourself into a player like Justin Turner by changing your swing, that's still a ways away from being the norm, because the super talented people have access to the same stuff, and we're grabbing the guys who hit it far and throw it hard.
Well, you forget, too. I mean, you can say whatever you want about Justin Turner being made into a player by changing his swing, but it's not like he was working at Home Depot. He played at Cal State Fullerton.
He was a big leaguer.
He was a major league player. Like, it just, it was taking a step. Or, and same thing with like a Max Muncy. Like, it's not like these dudes are waiting tables and all of a sudden they pick up another swing and voila, you're a major leaguer. Like, there was still something that made him, in the case of Turner, get recruited by one of the premier programs in the country. And then from there, get drafted by somebody. It's just certain people adjust it at certain speeds. So joined by Chris Atterbury, one of the voices of the Minnesota Twins. Of course, you're an indie ball guy. One of the stories that is making the rounds now is robot umps in the Atlantic League. I can't wait to see the robotic version of Cowboy Joe West.
I came in, it's a funny story, I came into my studio like a month ago and Cowboy Joe was sitting in my chair. He was going to have a little sit down with Dan Gladden, and I found out that Cowboy Joe West
was
quarterback for Elon College, and they lost then I think probably Division II national championship game to Wilbert Montgomery and Abilene Christian.
Seriously.
And I was like, all right, that's good for me. That's all I need to know today. I don't even need food for a week.
That's legit. I mean, that requires a degree of athleticism. Like, you wouldn't, you wouldn't know that he has it now, but
no, you wouldn't. You know, the robot I'm thinking is interesting. Why not try it? We all want it to be right. I mean, we were howling here the other day when Tyler Dusty struck out Luke Boyd with a sick curveball and the rookie ump balled it and it cost us, you know, a lead in the eighth inning. I tend to lean on the side of I don't mind some human error. In the game. I mean, it's humans trying to do something, and I think I don't mind if they mess up once in a while. Would robot ump solve everything, or does it just create a new batch of problems? You know, we talked about how we wanted a replay because we were going to get it right, and then we opened Pandora's box, and now if you make a great slide and you beat the ball to the base, and then you come off for a split second millimeter and the guy holds the glove on you, then all of that great base running isn't out because the eye in the sky. And I don't like that. So certainly when it goes against your team, you howl and you wish you had it, but I guess I can wait. I don't necessarily need to see robot umps. We got replay and I still don't think it gets it right very often with the way they've got it going. And I don't understand some of that. So I think honestly, robot umps will just lead you to a new batch of issues, frankly. So I also think there's something to be said for the skill of, he's calling that pitch, but he's not calling that pitch.
Absolutely.
Oh, this guy doesn't call the high pitch, but he calls the low pitch. There's something to be said for the vast amount of knowledge and skill that a catcher and a pitcher have to understand and manipulate that. In the same way that I'm sad that they've taken one of the great parts of the game away at second base in terms of turning double plays, where second basemen no longer have to be ballerinas. They don't have to understand how to get rid of the ball and use the base to protect themselves and low bridge a guy. Like, they don't have to. This whole skill set that made Bill Mazeroski a Hall of Famer, now we don't need it. Can you hit some bombs and maybe move 2 feet to your left and 2 feet to your right and shift? Okay, good. You don't have to turn. Don't worry about your feet. And I think that bums me out because that's a really beautiful part of the game that has been lost. We've got to watch Jonathan Scope play second all the time. And, boy, he's good at the bag. He's really, really, really good at the bag. And he's got a monster arm. And it's a part of the game that's gone now. And no one's out there working on footwork at second base because it's not part of the game, because they decided we chase that lead, made a bad slide, so everybody suffers. And there was already a rule in place for what Utley did to penalize him, and yet we had to change everything. So I'm really a little bit of a Luddite in terms of let's just change everything automatically. I think that gets a little knee-jerk for my liking.
Chris, I'm curious. There's a couple other rules changes that the Atlantic League is experimenting with. One of them is allowing a batter to steal first base on any wild pitch. Yeah. And then allowing batters to foul off a bunt with two strikes once and continue the at-bat without having be a strikeout. I'm curious about those potential rule changes and specifically being able to steal first after wild pitch, because talking about the Minnesota Twins catchers being able to frame pitches really well, I think it'll put more of an emphasis on catchers who can block. And, you know, I agree with you. It's fun to watch these rule changes to see how teams adjust and try to take advantage of the different rules and strategize. So what do you think about either of those potential rules changes?
Well, it's weird because the only reason people hate shifts is because 100 years ago people wind up in a certain spot. And so we assume that that's just the way that it was intended from the heavens. And it's the same way with the you can't bunt with two strikes thing. if you start thinking, like, well, why? Why is a foul ball there a strike but not if I'm swinging? It's weird, right? Like, it, so it doesn't make sense even at the beginning. And yet I'm loath to change it because that's how it's been. And I feel like if you're trying to sacrifice yourself and you can't do it in two pitches, then I think the pitcher should be rewarded in some respect. Like, you shouldn't get to keep trying. It also has, like, some Paul Molitor told me where he thought, in this day and age of rising strikeouts, if you get to 0-2 and you were trying to bunt, everybody strikes out anyway. So why not try to bunt again and maybe just get better at bunting and bunt with two strikes when they go back into the shift and are giving you a hit? So I think there is another area where the rule change allows you to not have to get better at a skill, which I'm not a big fan of. I think stealing first is just stupid. I mean, why not just get fast guys and wait for them to throw to the backstop? Like, I don't know. I think the whole point is you're supposed to swing and hit the ball. And we talk about wanting to speed the game up, so make them swing. I mean, make them swing at pitches. And the way to speed the game up is have people throw strikes and to call strikes. And I think that trying to manufacture things like the intentional walk rule. I had the privilege of watching the last intentional walk that led to a run because our guy threw it to the backstop in the Twins game. Pat Dean was the name of the guy. I think it was Pat Dean. Might have been a different guy. We had a lot of guys that year. And he threw one to the backstop, but they scored a run, and we lost the game because he couldn't execute an intentional walk. Now, he doesn't have to, because we don't, God forbid, we have to be able to deliver an intentional walk. And then they give you the lip service if it's to speed the game up. Okay, when you hit one in the seats, just go back to the dugout. Save me the 30-second trot. We'd save hours, just on Big Poppy alone. If you hit one in the seats, then just go to the dugout. But no one's talking about changing that rule. So I think it's a lot of eye wash. And I think stealing first is, frankly, I think it's just kind of stupid.
Yeah, I do have to agree with you there. I mean, you think about other rules too, like catchers blocking the plate. All right, the Buster Posey rule. There was something to be said. I don't know if Mike Socha has as long of a career as he did in the major leagues, if not for the fact that he was just able to withstand any possible hit at the plate.
Well, and we see a lot of times now where that it's actually made the game sloppier because catchers now have to just catch and sweep tag, and that leads to more, you know how hard that is with a ball coming from the outfield? It's really hard. And so now more balls get to the backstop, and, you know, it becomes a thing. So, I thought there were already rules in place. You can't cream a guy illegally on purpose without being penalized before. They never utilized the rule or executed it, but it was already in place, and they changed that one. And I just think, how much are you going to change? Like, this, the relief pitcher one where you can only face, you have to face three guys, like, that changes the entire complexity of how you manage a game, a skill that people develop in terms of matching up. Or careers of the Tony Sipps of the world are now out the door because of pitching changes. It's going to lead to longer games because a guy has to face three batters when maybe he can barely get one out, and now there's going to be a longer inning. You're just going to have the pitching changes after three hits instead of after one. So I just don't think they're very well thought out. And I think anytime you hamper a team's ability to do what they feel is their best route to win a game, I think you're messing with the integrity of the product.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. Not to mention, now can all those loogies sue for restrain of trade? I can't do it.
Are they doing what?
It's restrain of trade. Like, if you're not a left-handed one-out guy anymore because you can't get one out, like, it's hindering my ability. Does baseball lose its antitrust exemption? Like,
well, they won't, because the same guy who puts his arm around Sharon Robinson every April on Jackie Robinson Day signed a check to donate to white supremacist congressional Congress people so that they could get reelected and maintain the antitrust exemption in Congress. They spend more money with lobbyists and politicians so that they don't have to spend the same amount of money paying minor leaguers like a living wage and insurance. So that's never going to change.
Yeah, it's still mind-boggling when you look at what some of those guys down in the low minors make. These are guys who, even though they're in the low minors, are among the best on the planet at what they do. And for them to get a livable wage, you would think that would be a no-brainer. And, you know,
Well, and you'd think also it would make sense to invest in it, right? It's like, this is your product. Why wouldn't you put it in the absolute best? Why wouldn't you? If you bought a Lamborghini, but you weren't ready to drive it yet, you wouldn't put the bad fuel in it and leave it outside under the carport, right? You'd take care of it. And so if you get an 18, 19-year-old kid, don't you want them to have the best nutrition and not to be selling insurance in the off season or having to worry about living in an apartment with seven dudes? Wouldn't you want them to just focus on getting really good at baseball so they can steal first base? I just think it's a short-sighted developmental thing. And it's just going to take one team to be like, hey, you know what? We're going to pay. we're going to pay our guys. What do you need? We'll pay you insurance or whatever. And once that happens, and maybe if they win, then people copy. But an owner and an ownership group who has the financial foresight to recognize it as a business break, or they're just going to have to bribe Congress to give them some sort of tax loophole. That's probably more likely.
You know, anything's possible. I mean, you're talking about organizations. You know, when Frank McCourt owned the Dodgers, I used to negotiate with one of the guys in their minor league system who, even though we were in San Bernardino, it was 110 degrees, refused to buy Gatorade for the team. $100 for the Gatorade I couldn't get for the team when it was sweltering because McCourt wouldn't write the check for it. So,
well, as it turned out, he didn't have the money.
No, exactly. You know, I guess fair point, really. I mean, who would have ever thought? Yeah. And then of course, he sells the team and makes what off of that deal? Basically by running it to the ground. Anyway.
Never should have been allowed to have a team because he didn't have the money and used that lack of money to make a bazillion dollars that he then gave to his wife. So, ex-wife. it's a weird deal, man. It's a weird deal. And the funny thing is, all of this stuff, whether you're talking about, you know, Trevor Bauer designing pitches in the new age of technology, not buying Gatorade, that's all stuff Tim Bowden was writing about in Ball 4.
Yeah.
Same stuff. You know, Johnny Stain with his ball and a stick. And literally, guys bringing Gatorade into the Seattle Pilots clubhouse and never getting reimbursed by the team owner. I mean, it's the same stuff all these years later. So,
who knows? Who would have ever thought in a million years the more things change, the more they stay the same?
Yeah. And you know what? Part of that is, like, for all of these very real issues, and sometimes I feel like I need a shower being part of the industry after a game, there are so many amazingly talented, especially young players right now, that take my breath away with the stuff that they can do on a baseball field that I still keep wanting to watch.
So if you were going to pay to watch one, who's your guy?
Well, Trout is in a class by himself to the point where when we were in Oakland, I was talking to some of the guys about Matt Chapman. So you guys in the Eastern Conference probably never get to see. This guy's ridiculous. And we don't get to see him that much either, but he's a freak. And one of his teammates is like, he's the best player in the game. And I go, better than Trout? And they're like, oh, well, Trout doesn't count. Like, that's how good Mike Trout is, that other players don't even consider him when they start having these discussions because he's that much better than everybody else. But right there in your backyard, I mean, Bogart, Mookie Betts, Mookie down here, but he's ridiculous, right? Impossible not to cheer for with the way he plays the game. Francisco Lindor is like that. Trout is ridiculous. Our guy Buxton is phenomenal. Max Kepler is a great player to watch play. Matt Chapman is really, really good. Alex Bregman is a ridiculously talented young player. I mean, there are some dudes out there that are really, really fun to watch.
Do you think, because Rob Manfred, your favorite guy, Manfred seems to like to put it at the feet of the players that the players are not as good at marketing themselves as they should be. I think a case could be made that Rob Manfred is not as good at marketing the players as he could be.
They don't want them. They don't want to marry the players because that's power for the players. And again, it all goes back to this collective bargaining agreement where Tony Clark got run circles around in the last CBA where the players got, they took their meal money, cut it in half, put ATM machines outside the clubhouse, and extra bus seat in spring training. And in return, they just got hosed for like five more years. And that's every time that they get out lawyered, and certainly Rob's a good lawyer, they get out lawyered, and then the league does a little dance on their grave and celebrates, and it makes it more acrimonious. It's stupid because there's billions to be made for both sides. Both sides. And if they can just kind of pretend to get along, and instead it seems like they're intent on right now saying, well, we're not going to pay you for the first 6 years. That's when you're cheap. And we've decided a smart business decision is not to pay you then. After that, we'll just get the next batch of cheap players unless you're Bryce Harper. And from a business standpoint, it makes sense. But from a structural standpoint, the players are going, well, when are we supposed to get paid then? Historically, they were always underpaid, and then they were overpaid because they got paid for what they did while they were underpaid, and then it balanced out in the long run. And I understand from a business side why you're not signing a 31-year-old free agent to a monster deal. But the way it's set up now, the players really back themselves into a corner, and instead of saying, like, oh, you know what, you're right, for the long-term good of all involved, let's kind of maybe figure out how to tweak that. It's like, that's tough. What are you going to do about it? And that's not – nobody wins. Nobody wins with that. So I do think they do a very poor job of marketing some really, really bright, talented, smiling. You can see their faces on TV. I mean, I don't give it. Oh, the games are too long. But no, more Mike Trout is good for me. More Mike Trout is good for me. And he shouldn't have to go out and become have his own YouTube channel to market himself because baseball should be just eager to understand, like, oh my gosh, he's a really good dude. He's never in trouble. He he does everything exactly the way we always claim we want people to do it. But what we claim we want people to be and what we actually like as a fan base, always very different things, right? Someone told me the other day, they're like, well, Joe Mauer was everything that fans want. I go, no, he wasn't. He's anything that fans claim they want. A nice guy who's a good family man and stays at home. But they ripped him all the time. But if he had hit 40 home runs and his girlfriend, he probably would have been, you know, everyone would love him. It's like that's the double standard in fandom. So it's a weird thing.
All right, man. Well, always a pleasure to talk to you. I wish I could do it more. I wish we could sit there and watch a ball game together, but you're always busy. So thank you for the time. Thank you for joining us. Enjoy floating down a creek with your kid. That should be an awesome afternoon.
We are going to look out for the 70-inch sturgeon that somehow ended up in a in a Minneapolis watershed. Somehow, some way. It's like the Ruth Bader Ginsburg of sturgeon. It's just below the creek, keeping the order, and we're going to try not to eat play.
All right, man. Well, we appreciate it, and enjoy it. We'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, we'll talk to you later.
All right, buddy. Hey, it's Lauren Fox, the host of Fox on Sports on Bedford 105.1. You've been listening to some of our past highlights. Thanks so much for tuning in, and we hope you have a wonderful sports week.